And Patricia is reading to poor, kindly, patient Leonard her initial lecture to her advanced 4-11 class this spring, just in case she wants to use it later on for prose. Daisy is fiddling around with the tape recording.
No, Daisy, get away. Go on. Down. Down. Go on down. Go ahead. You're not allowed up there.
Okay. Oh, wait a minute. I missed a whole batch. I'm sorry. Gotta stop. Didn't. After I've heard from all of the rest of them, what they want to do and so forth.
Honey, I don't know what you're talking about. Are you starting your lecture?
No, I'm just talking about in general. I haven't started the lecture yet.
Oh.
After I've heard from the students, we're going to go around and I'm going to ask them what they want out of the course and so forth. Okay, now before we begin anything, I want to give you some of my favorite quotes about poetry, a few ideas, just so that you'll have an idea of who I am and what you're dealing with here. And also to get my words in edgewise before yours take over, because I want to hear lots from you. Some of the quotes will be familiar to some of you, but so be it. It won't hurt you to hear them again. Okay? So, first of all, here's a little paragraph about poetry I once shot off for someone about 6 or 7 years ago. I think it was in Contemporary Poets, maybe. I don't remember. Anyway, I've revised it a little bit for you.
Is it your poem?
No, it's a little statement by me.
Well, say that.
Even so, it's only part of what I believe, but I thought you might like to hear it. And this is the way it goes. Quote, "When I think of it, I guess I believe that each person has a real, mostly hidden, and quite likely beautiful, however greedy, childlike self, an id, which is potentially extremely dangerous unless recognized, greeted in open air, and that poetry attempts to reveal those selves to us so that we feel and understand them, thus reclaiming them and giving them dignity in the world, value in the greater community of other hidden selves. Poetry moves its readers to feel and understand themselves and others, and the exciting release of energy caused as that condition is approached is like the glimpses one sometimes gets of an ideal world, a democracy of separate individuals, a heaven of fully realized selves, whose differences are different aspects of the creative power that sprouts from each separate leaf on every tree, each canker, each apple, each single snowflake falling from the crowded skies. Also, this hidden self is seen not just in itself, but in its transactions with the world of others around and necessarily outside it. Because, of course, those are the only areas in which we can apprehend it by normal means. So a lot of the situations in which these selves are revealed will be natural ones.
Natural
ones. Situations which operate close to the instinctive bone, as in love or hate or the simplicity for harmony or catastrophe of the natural world itself, of religious or aesthetic longings, whatever is closest to those selves that are so often smothered by the demands of a society that gets along by emphasizing only one side of the self, appealing either to reason or to emotion separately. But man slash woman is both God and beast and wants to be both at the same time. Hence the main occupation of poetry, of all the arts, at least while we are on earth, is not only dreaming the godlike dreams of beasts, but sharing
godlike dreams
of beasts.
Beasts?
Mm-hmm. But sharing them with each other.
I would say the animals, it's more a word you can understand better.
Okay. And then to go from the ridiculous to the sublime, but still thinking about the purpose of poetry, here's a quote from Neruda that I've carried around in my billfold with me for years. It comes from his memoirs, and it is, quote, "The human crowd has been the lesson of my life. I feel that I'm part of the essential majority. I am one more leaf on the great human tree. Multitude and solitude will go on being the primary obligations of the poet in this century." And what he's concentrating on there, which I love, is the exchange, the in and out of the self to the world and the world to the self to its own self and to others. Another one who speaks of poetry as responsive to the other voice is Czesław Miłosz, who says, quote, "The purpose of poetry is to remind us how difficult it is to remain just one person, for our house is open. There are no keys in the doors, and invisible guests come in and out at will." I just love that quote because it
says... Invisible death?
Guests.
Yes, so.
I love that quote because it says, no matter how locked inside the body we are, however isolated, we do have these five senses in common. The imagery of taste, touch, sight, sound, and smell, which are revealed in the words and images with which we communicate with each other. We are alone, but not alone. These invisible guests keep coursing through us. Most people try to deny them, but they can't, not when poetry's on to them. Hence the famous Emily Dickinson definition of poetry. I mean, where does it come from but from the five senses? And you know the definition. If, when the hairs on the back of my neck stand on end, when I read something, I know that is poetry. That comes from those five senses, from the guests coming in and out of the body. And what is that, I ask you, but the equally famous shock of recognition. Oh, I feel that. Someone else feels it, too. That is what it is, the mystery. And then, still another take on the other voice, those invisible guests, comes from Galway Kinnell, commenting on Rilke's ninth elegy, the one where Rilke speaks, according to Kinnell, of that transformation of what is loved into ourselves when we look back on it from the other side of nature. And then he quotes from the elegy.
I don't understand that.
Well, you just have to let it sit for me. Maybe
from the other side of nature? What side of nature are we on? I don't know what the other side of nature is.
The inside. Maybe if you listen, you might understand it better as it goes on.
All right.
And he quotes from the elegy, "Praise the world to the angel, not the inexpressible realm. You can't impress him with the splendor of your feelings. So show him some ordinary thing which has been given form through the ages until it comes to life in our hands, part of ourselves. Tell him about things. He will stand amazed, as you did, beside the rope maker in Rome or the potter by the Nile. Earth, isn't this what you want? Invisibly to rise up in us? Is not your dream to be invisible someday? Earth, invisible." And then Galway Kinnell leaves the investigation of the other side of nature, the invisible, the spirit that we know is there, and just speaks himself of it, this thus.
This what?
Thus, he speaks. Theology and philosophy, with their large words, their abstract formulations, their airtight systems, which until recently they imagined would last forever, deal with paradigms of eternity. The subject of the poem is the thing which dies. Zeus on Olympus is a theological being. The swan who desires a woman enters the province of poetry. In Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani, so does Jesus. And you know that's when he says, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? Poetry is the wasted breath. This is why it needs the imperfect music of the human voice. This is why its words have no higher aim than to press themselves to us, to cling to the creatures and things we know and love, to be the ragged garments. It is through something radiant in our lives that we have been able to dream of paradise, that we have been able to invent the realm of eternity. But there is another kind of glory in our lives which derives precisely from our inability to enter that paradise or to experience eternity. That we last only for a time, that everyone and everything around us lasts only for a time. That we know this radiates a thrilling, tragic light on all our loves, all our relationships, even those moments when the world, through its poetry, becomes almost capable of spurning time and death. And then he ends back in the physical world in this strange little four-line poem. The earth is all that lives, and the earth shall not last. We sit on a hillside by the greasy grass, and our little shadow lies out in the blades of grass until sunset.
Well, you keep saying he. I would repeat the name occasionally. But a lot of people are being mentioned.
And I wanted to conclude these quotes by giving you a few from Donald Hall's famous article, Poetry and Ambition, but I don't think that's necessary. Maybe I'll do it next time. Instead, I'll just read to you the W.S. Merwin poem. Some of you may have seen On My Door. How many of you know this? The one called Berryman. Okay, I'll just read it. And I don't have it with me right now, Leonard, so I won't read it. Well, that's a pretty tall order there, full of a kind of dauntingly high seriousness. But what I would like to do in this workshop is to think of poetry as, I've said this many times before, a holy game. What I mean by that is that, sure, poetry is holy, since we're out after greatness, after that thing, that ineluctable thing we can't grasp. But also, art is a game, because it's artificial. It's not life. There's something of play that always enters into it. And so I see no reason why we shouldn't enjoy ourselves as we work at the play of art, and that we shouldn't work together at all this. Soon enough, you will be all alone out there, working in complete isolation with no workshops, no one to talk with you. And you remember when they asked W.H. Auden who he read nowadays, and he said, oh, the old masters, not your peers, they said. And he said, no, I did when I was young, but no one ever reads his contemporaries with the same passion when they're old as they do when they're young. And when you're young, you're all together, you're working, you want to help each other, and then you leave each other behind. And so this is your time. This is the time when you need to be listening to each other. So let us really enjoy these 15 weeks that we have together. Please be sure to speak to each other after class, to ask what each other means by critiquing, and talk about the poems we've read. Above all, when you're reading each other's poems, be generous. Look first for the author's intention. whether or not you agree with what the poet wants to say. Look for what you think it is that he wanted to say. Then look for the other voice in the poem, the invisible guests, the heart of it, what it wants to be, and try to help each poem become its best self. Treat it, above all, as if it were your own poem, after you've understood it. And then be critical of it, too, in the same way you would be if it were your own.
This is an entirely new class.
Yeah. So now, to be a little
now
more...
Now, what's the number of it, by the way?
411, is that. So now, to be a little more technical, and this is a part I wrote this morning, it seems to me that there are two places poetry comes from, two areas in your life you must court if you want to become the poet you dream of being.
You must what?
Court.
Court, oh.
The first one is the silence inside yourself, the place where you not only talk and listen to yourself, but also the place where the real you receives and processes the outside world.
Receives what?
And processes the outside world as by the media of the five senses, it flows in and out of your consciousness. It's the kind of silence that the mystics are always talking about. The silence that seems to precede language. The sense of a kind of numinousness about experience, if you want to quote Auden. And then a need, a pressure, for the poet anyway, to encounter that experience with language, and thus not only articulate it for herself, but share it with others. And in order to court that silence, to encourage it, of course, you have to shut up. You have to be quiet. You have to think, you have to listen, and feel, all by yourself, alone in your room. It's a kind of meditation, if you will, but it can be a walking meditation, you probably know about that, or even a running meditation, if you will. But in any case, such alert, excited, sympathetic attentiveness always for a poet flows into the second area you must court. And that's the hustling, bustling, crowded, juicy, wonderfully luscious arena of words themselves. And here, I think, with such pleasure, of the old Jesuitical instructions I once read for meditation, which said, meditate, yes, but always have a piece of paper and a pencil beside you. So if you have any good ideas, you write them down, and then you go on meditating, because it's... the putting of the pen to paper is putting the words down for poets, for human beings maybe, that matters. It's astonishing in poetry how paying attention to detail, to the materials of poetry, especially the words and the images they embody, can move a poem, help it to help you and the poem grow organically, naturally, towards the revelation, the shock of surprise both poet and reader are always looking for. And it's just the words that can do it. It's amazing.
It's just what?
Words. All you have to do is look at words, which are jam-packed with layer upon layer of information and emotion. Someone talks about the little histories of words, the etymology, where they came from. They're loaded with ore. Emerson said that writing is, I think he said, is like lying in the lap of language, as if language itself thought. And there's a way in which you just, if you just relax into the words, they tell you so much about what you're feeling, about what the world is feeling. You move from word to image to image to word. Here's a lovely quote from Dylan Thomas on that very same issue. I make one image, though make is not the word. I let, perhaps, an image be made emotionally in me, and then apply to it what intellectual and critical forces I possess. Let it breed another. Let that image contradict the first. Make of the third image bred out of the other two together a fourth contradictory image, and let them all, within my imposed formal limits, conflict. Each image holds within it the seed of its own destruction, and my dialectical method, as I understand it, is a constant building up and breaking down of the images that come out of the central seed, which is itself destructive and constructive at the same time. And then that makes me think, oh, post-structuralist critics, what are you thinking about? The poets were there before you. Out of the inevitable conflict of images, the womb of war, I try to make that momentary peace, which is a poem. It's a wonderful, interesting... momentary peace.
No, before that, the what of war?
The womb.
Of war?
Yeah.
What is the womb of war?
Where there are the images conflicting with each other. This dialectical method, in which you're always aware of the underside of an image, the shadow part of it.
You might give an example there.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay.
Excuse me, Kitty.
And besides that, it's part of the great fun of writing, to play with words, to let words talk to you, to relax into them, to use them, to see what they're telling you. And it doesn't matter what kinds of words either. It doesn't matter what kinds of words you use either. Elk, just as much as polyester. Nitroglycerin, just as much as stream. Shredded wheat, or diet Pepsi, or pistol, just as much as cream, or melancholy, or horse. I had a great deal of fun writing that little list. It allowed me, in the middle of my working day, as I was writing this out, to visit my nightlife, my sleeping night, in which one of the games I play, and I urge it upon all of you, is, especially when I can't sleep, I make up lists of words. I decide I'm going to do a lot of off-rhyming words. And that's most fascinating, where I wind up. Starting with a word, then an off-rhyme for it.
Can't you give it an example?
Maybe I will. I've already given so many. Or I do rhyming words. I just try lists of rhymes. Or I just do words, every word I can think of that begins with B. Or I think of every word in a category of fruit beginning with A, apple, and going all the way down. Yeah. But the most fun I have is when I start with an off-rhyming, say apple, what that might be, a dapple is a true rhyme, but apple, tautological.
A couple,
calumnity. There's a sense apple and calumnity is going in there, and I have a wonderful time doing
not
that.
Not calumny, not calumnity.
Okay,
calamity,
you.
Maybe.
And that's a kind of game that is much closer to the mother lode of real feeling and thinking about life than I think any of us ever can guess, because we've been riding on language for a long time. We've been living in its lap, if Emerson is right. We've been talking to each other through it. And if you attend to that and attend to this, the other part, the silence, then you're on your way.
Where did that come from, the silence?
I just mentioned it. Silence.
The other part, the silence.
I just mentioned it. You've forgotten it. I talked about the silence, the meditative core.
We better refer back to that. That's pretty far away.
And by the way, incidentally, but not incidentally, as you realize, when you see how smoothly the idea of rhyme has crept into our discussion, my discussion of diction and vocabulary, rhyme and rhythm, the melodies and the rhetorical patterns of poetry, the complements or opposites of silence.
Silence.
As silver is complementary to gold in, quote, speech is silver, but silence is golden, are almost equally important. Those complements are equally important, rhyme and rhythm, maybe just as important in this area as language itself. In other words, you have language, but the way the language is used, the rhymes and the rhythms and rhetorical patterns in which it's used are just as important. Anyway, what these two areas, the area of the silence, the quietness at the center of yourself, and then the area of language, mean to us as readers and critics of each other's work, is that we must be alert to both sides all the time. When I know a lot of you have taken workshops from Mark Levine, and he was in my office for a while last year and this fall, and I loved it when I came to my office because he had a little card on the door which said, there was a picture of a Dick Tracy and detective, I guess, and it said investigate underneath it. I don't know what he meant by that, but I was turned on by that little picture, and I realized that part of what we do in a workshop is investigate like detectives. Not only the overall pattern of the crime, the structure, intention, motivation, what and how, out of this of the crime of the poem, not only the overall pattern of the crime of the poem, let's say, the act of the poem, not only the structure, the intention, the motivation, what and how, out of the silence it came from, it wants to say about the world, but also each and every least clue, each particular of diction, tone, particular word choice, rhyme, rhythm, syntax, grammatical structure, each line break and caesura, and so on and on and on, like blood type, like fingerprints, etc. Those clues, which put all together, will help us not only to understand all of them why, but how successfully or unsuccessfully the act, the crime of the poem has been committed. And that's it. And I go into procedure.
Procedure?
Yeah.
Okay.
Wait a minute.